Nancy Isenberg's best-selling book, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America, is now out in paperback with a new preface covering the 2016 election. Isenberg said the following about the political climate years ago surrounding Sarah Palin: when you turn an election into a three-ring circus, there's always a chance that the dancing bear will win. We recognize how right she is today, yet the voters that put Trump in the White House have always been a permanent part of our American fabric. In White Trash, Isenberg looks to obliterate the myth of America as a land of unbounded opportunity and social mobility, and makes the case that while both class and identity politics matter, neither are sufficient alone to define categories of voting behavior. Again, the title of the book, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And we are pleased to welcome Nancy Isenberg to the roundtable this morning. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you on the program again. We had you when the book first came out, and it's a delight to have you come back. Since that time, what has changed, especially given the election and in the reaction to the book and the discussion that we are having as a society, do you think?
Well, I do think that the important part of the book is that so many readers have written me really nice emails and said that, you know, this is a part of our history that I never learned in high school or college, and that's part of the message. The message is that we prefer to celebrate the myths of American exceptionalism, that somehow at the time of the American Revolution, we broke free from the British class system. We got rid of a titled aristocracy. But the truth is that at the very same time, we adopted important concepts taken from the British and the English to define a class system. And one of the key ones is the idea of waste people. That's where the idea of white trash comes from, which emphasized the similarity between wastelands and waste people, where wastelands were lands left that were unfit for cultivation, that were left fallow and unproductive. And this obsession with idleness, this obsession with the poor, was very much connected to how the topography, the land that you live on, defines you and your class station. So the other theme that I highlight is the importance of breeding. We inherited the ideas of pedigree, lineage, this notion that poor whites by the early 19th century are seen as a breed apart. They're identified for their yellow tinge to their skin. They are given derogatory names called sandhillers because, again, they live on inferior land made of sand. They are called clay eaters. And they are also measured not only by their labor value, but they are seen as people who are measured by the unhealthiness of their children, that their children and their offspring are seen as inferior to the middle class and the upper class at this time. So these are things we often don't think about, class. Class is something that's reproduced. And this is a theme about breeding that would finally culminate in its most extreme form with the rise of the eugenic movement, where the state was given the power to sterilize people who were seen as inferior and dangerous and should not be allowed to breed. And the group that was most targeted for sterilization in this period of the eugenics movement were poor white women.
So let me just turn around then and ask you how you put this into a context of what we've seen over the past year, specifically during the 2016 election, and how that has manifested itself over the last 12 months.
Well, one of the things I also talk about in the book, I not only talk about how class becomes part of the cultural vocabulary, and it changes over time, but I also talk about the way it intersects with the emergence of democracy. And I spend a great deal of time talking about Andrew Jackson. Jackson was the first president who had a campaign biography. He was marketed as the candidate for the common man, even though he was a wealthy landowner and slave owner. And he was very much seen as someone associated with the southern backcountry of Tennessee. He was the first Westerner to be elected president. So at that moment, there became a new demand where American democracy required all of its presidential candidates to appeal and to even dress and talk as if they came from the common classes or the working classes, as opposed to being elite statesmen, as were the likes of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And this is something that did affect the election. One of the things that supporters of Trump often said in defending him and why they liked him is they just said he was a straight talker. They said he spoke with a raw honesty. He wasn't playing the part of a politician. He was unscripted. Even his insults were seen as a greater sign of authenticity. So what we've had in American society, and this is a concept that goes back to the 19th century, but it was best articulated by an Australian observer in 1949 who said that we do not have a real democracy in the United States. We have a democracy of manners. And in a democracy of manners, we allow for huge disparities of wealth, but we expect all of our political candidates to act like the rest of us, at least when they're on the campaign trail. And not only did Trump speak with a raw honesty, he wore his Bubba cap. And this pattern we can find in many recent presidents. I highlight Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton invoked the ghost of Elvis, a Mississippi sharecropper, and you remember played the Heartbreak Hotel on the Arsenio Hall show. He wore a Bubba cap. There was a magazine, the Bubba magazine, dedicated to Bill Clinton. So he very much played the part of, you know, someone who came from a working class background, but then had to present it in a way that was seen as appealing and wasn't seen as threatening. So he invoked the Elvis of the 1950s that was seen as a much more positive way to imagine Elvis and a way to reach across the class divide. Because as we know, Bill Clinton graduated from Yale Law School.
Right.
And even George Herbert Walker Bush had to campaign with a country singer, despite his blue blood WASP roots, and claim that he loved pork rinds. So there's this whole problem in America where we get involved with the performative side of the campaign. Voters identify with the metaphoric identity, not the real identity of the candidate or even their policies. So this is, I think, something that has been exposed in this campaign and has had a lot to say with the way in which politics has reframed the class divide in America. And that's one of the things I emphasize in my preface. I talk about the metaphors, the contrasting metaphors that were exploited during the campaign, where Clinton Democrats were associated with pedigreed elites, Trump Republicans thought of themselves as disinherited. You had the urban insider, the rural outsider, the cosmopolitan, the provincial, professionals versus working stiff, meritocracy versus hard work, faith in upward mobility versus fear of losing class status. And these themes that were exploited in this election and emphasized also do tap into a longer, older history of how we think of class and how we measure class in this society, where it is about not only do the pedigreed elites have access to the best colleges. This is something that we sort of assume is the only path up the social ladder, when in fact many Americans do not get a college education. Right now, only 32.5% of Americans from college age to 60 have a college education. So part of what this election tapped into is reminding us that we have a much more diverse population, but we have to realize that the idea that everyone can get education, become a white-collar professional, is just simply not true. It's not true in the design of our capitalist system, and we like to sort of mythologize that that's open for everyone, when in fact it hasn't been in the past and it isn't true today.
So when you have Bernie Sanders during the Democratic primary, and you touch on this in the preface, when you have Bernie Sanders saying that there should be a class revolution, should there
right.
be?
Yeah, I mean, he invoked, and we, you know, Bernie Sanders, he sort of reminds me of these, you know, 60s rabble-rousers who invokes the language of class. But when he said that, he also at the same time narrowed what he imagined this class revolution. So he also played the rhetorical game. It's democracy. If we go back to the antebellum period with many politicians were stump speakers. So there is so much emphasis on the performative side. And clearly, we all know that Bernie Sanders was a much better stump speaker than Hillary Clinton. But what he promised, at the same time he called for class revolution, what he was really promising was allowing for free tuition to colleges. And Bernie Sanders also fell into the trap of assuming that the most extreme poverty is something that white Americans have not felt. And that's because he was not embracing our history and even current American society, because today 42% of Americans who live below the poverty line are white. And he was using the 60s trope of the ghetto as his metaphor for poverty. So this is one of the things that we do have to understand. We have to realize how race and class intersect, and we also have to realize that politicians draw on old scripts from previous presidents, gestures, and even from the grab bag of popular culture. But they invoke a language that often is completely divorced from the actual policies that they're going to endorse.
Final question. We only have a minute left. But when you look at this history and this 400-year untold history, do you feel that this story is being told more?
Well, I still think there's this compelling desire to hide this history, and I write about that tension all along. We would prefer, and politicians would prefer, to talk about the myth. They would prefer to use the rhetoric, which papers over reality. But I think that this election did open up wounds. People became more aware of class. But it's also, I think, it would not surprise me if there was a shift again to try to hide class and try to minimize its significance, because it's very difficult for Americans to talk about class openly and honestly. And I think that's it wouldn't, because I've seen this in the past, I wouldn't be surprised if that happened again. I'm hoping that Americans will begin to talk about class in a more forthright manner, but there's no guarantee that will happen.
Nancy Eisenberg's best-selling book, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America, is now out in paperback. It is published by Penguin. Nancy, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.